If you're an RIA or looking to become one, Schwab Advisor Services is the Watson to your homes. Smart, dependable, always has your back. It's no mystery why they're the number one choice for RIAs who want to be the ultimate solution for their clients. With all the wealth services, technology, and support your firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Follow the clues at schwabvious.com.
Welcome to the Daily Story Brief. Today, we're looking at something that honestly felt more like a Hollywood production than a diplomatic visit.
You're talking about the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, at the White House.
Exactly. MBS. It was his first time back in Washington in 7 years, and the reception was just... it was off the charts.
It really was. I mean, if you want a signal about where things are heading, you just have to look at the sheer theatricality of it all. This was designed to be a monumental event.
It wasn't just a handshake in the Oval Office.
Oh, not at all. We saw a full military flyover. There was a procession with horses on the South Lawn. And then this black tie dinner that was just packed with a who's who of powerful figures.
Right. I saw the guest list. You had people like Elon Musk and Tim Cook, the heads of America's biggest tech companies.
And then cultural icons like Cristiano Ronaldo was there. It was a spectacle.
And that level of pomp is so extraordinary, especially when you remember MBS isn't technically the head of state. His father, King Salman, is.
Right. But this reception basically solidified that the U.S. views MBS as the real power player, the indispensable man. This wasn't just diplomacy as usual. It was a very high-stakes negotiation.
A negotiation to, what, fix a relationship that's been pretty strained lately?
To consolidate it.
Yeah.
Put it on a new foundation. The visit formalized these massive, massive agreements across defense, technology, energy, you name it. It was about Riyadh locking in its strategic future.
A future that's about more than just oil.
Exactly. It's a future where they're trying to move away from being solely dependent on oil exports. And the message this sends to the rest of the region, especially to a country like Iran, is crystal clear.
Which is?
That Saudi Arabia is cementing its role as Washington's number one strategic partner in the region.
Okay, let's unpack this then. We need to look at how Saudi Arabia basically walked away with its entire strategic wish list. And we have to talk about that $1 trillion pledge, which is just a staggering number.
And the geopolitical hurdles that are still in the way. Specifically, the Abraham Accords and, of course, the lingering shadow of Jamal Khashoggi's murder.
Right. So let's start with the big strategic piece. The thing that happened at that dinner.
The major non-NATO ally designation.
President Trump made this surprise announcement calling Saudi Arabia an MNNA. He said it was, quote, very important to the Saudis.
And it is. This is so much more than just a diplomatic handshake. It's a profound change. It's a symbolic and a very practical restructuring of the entire defense relationship.
So what did it look like before, just us selling them weapons?
It was transactional, exactly. We sold them equipment, we shared some intelligence. But MNNA status, that puts Saudi Arabia in a really elite group.
Who else is in that group?
They're the 20th country to get this status. You're talking about core U.S. partners like Israel, Japan, South Korea, Australia. So symbolically, this just elevates the relationship to a whole new level. It's peer-to-peer.
Okay, so this is the question I think everyone's going to have right away. Does this make Saudi Arabia a true NATO ally? Like, are we now legally bound to defend them if they get attacked?
That's the most important distinction, and the answer is a definitive no. Absolutely not.
Okay.
MNNA status is a legal designation, but it explicitly does not create that automatic defense obligation that you see in Article 5 of the NATO treaty.
So if Russia attacks Poland, we have to defend Poland.
We are bound by treaty to defend Poland. If Iran attacks Saudi Arabia, the U.S. is not legally required to send troops. Now, the strategic situation might push us to do it anyway, but there's no legal requirement. It's an enhancement of cooperation, not a mutual defense pact.
So if it's not a defense pact, what are the concrete technical benefits they get? What makes this the top item on their wish list?
The benefits are huge, and they're really focused on integrating Saudi Arabia into the U.S. defense industry and its technology pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
There are about five major advantages. First, they're now eligible to participate in joint Pentagon research and development programs. This is a massive deal. It means Saudi defense experts get this unprecedented access to early stage U.S. military innovation.
So they're not just buying stuff off the shelf anymore.
Not at all. They're in the lab, so to speak. Second, they get streamlined military procurement. It just cuts through a ton of bureaucratic red tape.
Meaning they can buy things faster.
Much faster, especially certain sensitive U.S. defense technologies that would take other partners years to get approved.
That seems critical for them, especially with their Vision 2030 plan to modernize everything so quickly. What about, say, older U.S. hardware?
That's the third benefit. MNNA partners get priority access to what's called excess U.S. military equipment.
Mm-hmm.
When the U.S. military upgrades its tanks or its planes, the old stuff, which is still highly effective, gets sold off.
And Saudi Arabia now gets to be first in line.
They move to the front of the line. It's a way to bolster their defenses very quickly and often at a much lower cost. Then fourth, they can get loans of certain U.S. equipment for cooperative research.
So they can try before they buy, essentially.
Sort of. It's not permanent, but it gives them temporary access to really sophisticated, expensive gear for training and seeing how it integrates with their systems.
And what about the economic angle? MVS wants to build a real domestic defense industry. How does this help?
That's the fifth benefit. And for Vision 2030, this might be the most important one. Saudi defense companies, specifically their big state-owned one, SAMI, can now bid on Department of Defense maintenance and repair contracts for U.S. systems outside the U.S.
Whoa. So a Saudi company could be fixing U.S. military gear in, say, Europe or Asia?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
It's not just about them buying from the U.S. anymore. It establishes them as a recognized commercial partner in the global defense ecosystem.
That really feels like a direct policy tool. Like the U.S. is trying to encourage them to look to us for partnership, not to Russia or China.
It absolutely is. And this all comes with a new strategic defense agreement that explicitly names the U.S. as their primary partner. And crucially, Saudi Arabia committed to new burden-sharing funds.
Meaning they're going to pay for some of the costs of U.S. forces in the region.
They're defraying U.S. costs. It's a two-way street. They get the prestige and the access, and the U.S. gets funding and a formal promise that keeps Riyadh tethered to Washington.
You know, it's a fascinating trade-off. The U.S. gives away all this military and tech access, but we keep the flexibility of not having a defense treaty.
And on the other side, Saudi Arabia gets the prestige of being in the same club as Israel and Japan,
mm-hmm.
but without having to make all the democratic or political commitments that usually come with that.
It's the ultimate transactional alliance.
It really is. It's focused purely on mutual national security and economics. And it shows that MBS has been very successful in navigating what Washington wants. He leveraged Saudi wealth and its geography to get a status that honestly was almost unthinkable just a few years ago.
It signals that for Washington right now, integrating Riyadh into its defense structure is just a higher priority than pushing for political reform.
That's the bottom line.
Okay, so the MNNA status is the framework, but the centerpiece, the actual hardware everyone was talking about, was the F-35 fighter jet deal.
Right. The U.S. formalized a commitment to sell up to 48 F-35s to the kingdom, plus a huge deal for nearly 300 tanks. This is just a monumental transfer of stealth technology.
And you said the F-35 isn't just another plane.
It's a whole different ballgame. The F-35 is the most advanced, most expensive, and most secretive weapons system the U.S. has. It's a fifth-generation jet. It's defined by stealth, by how it fuses all its sensor data. It's basically a flying data hub for the entire battlefield.
And selling that to Saudi Arabia has immediate consequences.
Massive implications for the balance of power in the region. And it runs headfirst into one of the biggest constraints in U.S. defense policy in the Middle East.
Israel's qualitative military edge, the QME.
The QME is the absolute defining tension here. Israel is the only country in the Middle East that operates the F-35 right now. They call the version the F-35I a deer.
And they see that exclusive access is essential for their security.
Absolutely. They need to know their military is always technologically ahead of any combination of regional adversaries. And U.S. law actually mandates that the White House has to ensure Israel's QME is preserved before approving any major arms sale in the region.
So the U.S. has to walk this incredibly fine line, give the Saudis what they want for modernization, but at the same time, keep Israel's technological superiority. How has that worked in the past?
Well, historically, the U.S. managed it by selling downgraded equipment to Arab states. The classic example is in the 1990s when we sold F-15S fighter jets to Saudi Arabia.
But they weren't the same as the Israeli ones.
Exactly. The U.S. intentionally gave the Saudi jets inferior radars and downgraded electronic warfare systems compared to the Israeli version. That was the political price of making the sale happen.
But the F-35 is different. The whole jet is one big sensitive piece of tech. So what are the two big worries for U.S. and Israeli officials with this sale?
The first, obviously, is just upsetting Israel's QME. If Israel feels its main deterrent is gone, that could be destabilizing. But the second concern, and this is often the one that really slows these deals down, is the risk of the technology being compromised.
You mean falling into the wrong hands?
Specifically China. Given Saudi Arabia's growing financial and tech ties with Beijing, there's a real fear that China could get unauthorized access to the F-35 secrets.
Protecting that stealth tech is everything. So if the risks are that high, how does a deal like this actually move forward? What are the workarounds?
There are three main compromises, technical and political, that are being built into the deal.
Okay.
First is what's called a capability differential. So yes, the Saudis get the F-35. But Israel often gets specific rights to customize and enhance their jets in ways no one else can.
So it's the same plane, but it's not the same plane.
Precisely. The Israeli F-35I Adir has unique U.S.-supported modifications. The sources we looked at point specifically to things like external fuel compartments.
Which lets them fly farther.
Thousands of miles, round trip, without refueling. That's a capability that's critical for striking deep targets, like in Iran. So even the Saudis have the same basic airframe, Israel keeps a unique operational edge. They can also integrate their own indigenous systems into the jet software.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second one?
The second one is a technological failsafe. And this is really unique to the F-35. Because the plane is so heavily dependent on software and data links, experts point out that it's inherently, quote, vulnerable to a kill switch.
A kill switch? You mean the U.S. could just turn it off? Tell me about that.
Well, the F-35 operates on this huge network called ALAI, the Autonomic Logistics Information System. The U.S. maintains control over the core mission software and all the updates. So in an extreme crisis, say the plane was stolen, or the regime in Riyadh dramatically changed its alignment, the U.S. could, in theory, remotely issue a command to render the jet inoperable.
So you could just brick a $100 million fighter jet?
Essentially, yes. You could disable its sensitive sensors or flight controls. It's an unprecedented security safeguard that you just didn't have with older planes.
I have to imagine that's politically tricky for the country buying the jet. You're spending billions on equipment. The seller can just switch off.
It's very contentious. But it's the reality of buying this level of U.S. technology. It's a trade-off Riyadh has to make if they want the F-35.
Yeah.
The U.S. basically keeps a veto over the jet's functionality, which directly addresses that risk of the tech getting compromised.
Okay, so beyond the F-35, MBS came with a whole sophisticated shopping list. It seems like he wants to do more than just buy planes.
Oh, absolutely. The focus is overwhelmingly on next-generation unmanned systems, the future of warfare. They're looking to buy hundreds of MQ-9 Reaper drones, the big, proven surveillance and strike drones.
But not just the big stuff.
No. They're also talking to smaller, more cutting-edge U.S. companies, like a startup called Shield AI, for their AI-supported VBAT drones.
So they're buying AI-integrated drone tech. They're trying to leapfrog ahead, not just buy what's available now.
Precisely. And this all ties back to their long-term industrial goal. They are seeking cooperation on, and this is their phrase, the localization of content.
They want to build it themselves.
They want U.S. partners to help their state-owned manufacturer, SAMI, develop the infrastructure and the know-how to design, manufacture, and maintain complex weapons systems inside Saudi Arabia. The ambition is to go from being a consumer to a serious global defense player.
And the MNNA status is the key that unlocks the door to that kind of U.S. cooperation.
It's the only practical way for them to get there.
Okay, let's shift from military power to economic power, because we have to talk about the money. This might be the most headline-grabbing part of the whole visit.
The financial pivot is just staggering.
MBS committed to dramatically raising the planned U.S. investment from an already huge $600 billion.
To nearly $1 trillion for the next year. It's a figure that's almost impossible to really comprehend.
And the sources say this wasn't even planned, that the number went up during the meeting itself.
That's right. Apparently it happened in the Oval Office. MBS essentially corrected the president's figure upwards. He said they'd be committing to almost $1 trillion of investment, real investment. This massive commitment is what underpins this entire restored relationship.
So why the sudden massive increase? Is it just about economics, or is this the leverage he's using to get the F-35s and the MNNA status?
It's both, but you can't deny the strategic leverage. The $1 trillion commitment is Saudi Arabia's way of saying, our future is tied to yours, and we will pay a premium for security. It's concrete proof to Washington that they are prioritizing economic ties with the U.S. over anyone else.
And for President Trump, he can point to that and talk about American jobs.
Repeatedly, He emphasized that this translates directly to U.S. jobs, investments in plants, in companies, money on Wall Street, but fundamentally, jobs for Americans. It makes the partnership much more politically sellable back home, especially with all the human rights concerns we'll get to later.
So where is this $1 trillion actually going? The sources point to a massive, aggressive push into one area in particular, artificial intelligence.
Yes. And they believe they have a unique advantage in the race to become a global AI hub.
Which is?
Energy economics. It's highly disruptive. Advanced AI needs massive data centers. And these data centers are incredibly power hungry. They run 24/7.
And Saudi Arabia has a lot of energy.
And it's cheap. Their vast oil and gas reserves let them provide cut-rate electricity prices. This drastically reduces the cost of running a massive data center compared to doing it in the U.S. or Europe or China.
So they're using their old resource oil to power the technology of the future AI. That's a critical point. How much of a difference does that actually make?
It's transformative. Energy costs can be 60, even 70% of a data center's total operating budget. By offering subsidized energy, they can undercut global competitors in a huge way. It's a brilliant move to shift their economy from pure extraction to knowledge-based services.
So what are they doing right now to make this happen?
Well, their public investment fund, the PIF, is driving all of this. PIF-owned companies, like an AI firm called Humane, are planning to buy thousands of NVIDIA's new Blackwell chips.
Those are the most advanced AI chips available.
The absolute top of the line, essential for training large AI models. On top of that, another Saudi company, DataVolt, is building a $5 billion data center on the Red Sea coast. And MBS himself said they plan to invest $50 billion just in buying U.S.-made semiconductor chips to meet their huge demand.
But just like with the F-35s, this has to be raising red flags in Washington about security.
It absolutely is. The concern is the dual-use nature of this technology. U.S. officials are very worried that China could use these Saudi deals to gain access to cutting-edge American AI tech. The transfer of some of these advanced NVIDIA chips has already been delayed because of these exact concerns.
So MBS was pushing to get those unlocked during the visit.
Pushing hard. Arguing they're critical for their economic future and not meant for anyone else.
Okay, so parallel to AI, there was another huge tech deal being negotiated. Civilian nuclear energy.
Right, and they signed what they called a historic multi-billion dollar deal. It basically sets up the framework for a long-term civilian nuclear energy partnership. It names U.S. companies like Westinghouse and Bechtel as the preferred partners to build the reactors.
And it comes with non-proliferation rules.
Very strict non-proliferation standards. The U.S. goal is to help them build a power grid, not a weapons program.
But the big sticking point, the thing that could still break the deal, is Saudi Arabia's insistence on being allowed to enrich uranium on its own soil.
This is the major hurdle. Saudi Arabia has huge domestic reserves of raw uranium. And their energy minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, could not have been more clear. He said, "We will enrich it and we will sell it and we will do a yellow cake."
Yellow cake being the first processed form of uranium.
Correct. And they're insisting on this for two reasons.
Yeah.
Economics. They want to control the whole fuel cycle and national pride. They see it as a mark of sovereignty.
This is a totally different approach from what the UAE did with their nuclear program.
A complete contrast. In 2009, the UAE signed what's called a 123 agreement with the U.S. They agreed to the gold standard, making a legally binding promise not to enrich uranium domestically.
A concession they made to get the deal done?
A huge concession. And it was critical to getting U.S. support for their nuclear power plant. Saudi Arabia is looking at that and saying, "We're not willing to make that same concession."
So if the Saudis want enrichment and the U.S. wants non-proliferation, what's the potential trade-off? How do you bridge that gap?
The consensus among policy experts is that there's one thing that might get Saudi Arabia to back down from enrichment.
Which is?
A credible, formalized U.S. nuclear umbrella, a security guarantee.
In return for giving up enrichment, they get U.S. nuclear protection.
Exactly. It would address their main security worry, nuclear Iran, without them having to build their own capability.
What would that realistically look like? A formal defense treaty seems like it would never pass the Senate.
It's very unlikely. So it would probably be done through executive action. It could mean deploying U.S. nuclear-capable aircraft to bases on Saudi soil. Or it could mean committing nuclear-armed submarines to constantly patrol the Indian Ocean with a clear public defense commitment to Riyadh.
So MBS is trying to buy not just planes and ships, but the ultimate security guarantee.
That's precisely what this is. He's using $1 trillion of financial leverage to secure strategic assets that fundamentally change his country's long-term position against its main rival, Iran.
Okay, let's move from the money to the delicate geopolitical chessboard. A huge focus of the visit was the Abraham Accords.
Yes, President Trump has made it clear that getting Saudi Arabia to join the Accords is essential for long-term stability in the Middle East.
The Accords being the deals that normalize ties between Israel and countries like the UAE and Bahrain.
Right. And those were foundational, but Saudi Arabia is the ultimate prize. They're the largest Arab economy, they have immense financial power, and crucially, they are the custodian of Islam's two holiest sites.
So if they join, it legitimizes Israel's place in the region in a way no one else can.
Exactly. And Trump was very optimistic, publicly saying he expects them to join very shortly.
MBS was crystal clear about his one non-negotiable condition. And it's the thing that's blocking this whole negotiation.
It is. That condition is securing a clear, guaranteed path to an independent Palestinian state. He said it plainly. We want to be part of the Abraham Accords, but we want also to be sure that we secure a clear path of a two-state solution.
Okay, so think about this. The U.S. just offered them MNNA status, F-35s, $1 trillion, and he still wouldn't drop this condition. That tells you how big the gap is between Riyadh and Jerusalem.
The gap is immense, and it's really defined by Israel's current internal politics. The ruling coalition in Israel is, as our sources put it, steadfastly opposed to a Palestinian state.
So it's an impossible situation for Washington. They've offered MBS almost everything he could want.
But the one political thing he's demanding is a complete non-starter for the current Israeli government.
And the current environment after the war in Gaza just makes it even harder. The images of that conflict are still so fresh.
And you have ongoing Israeli settler violence in the West Bank. Any move toward normalization right now without a huge visible concession for the Palestinians would be politically toxic for the Saudi leadership. They can't afford the backlash.
So they're stuck.
They're stuck. The economic and security benefits of the Accords are just not worth the regional instability it would create for them without progress on the Palestinian issue.
So let's shift to the other big security threat here, Iran. Some experts were saying that given how hard normalization is, the real focus of this meeting should have been a joint strategy for dealing with Tehran.
That's where the immediate high-stakes threat really lies. After the recent escalations between Israel and Iran, and with Tehran's continued military buildup and nuclear advances, the chance of a renewed, bigger conflict is very high.
Which is terrifying for the Gulf states.
Especially for Saudi Arabia. They're terrified of becoming a proxy battleground. They worry about attacks on their oil infrastructure or even a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz.
So MBS has a huge incentive to push for de-escalation, not confrontation.
A massive incentive.
Right.
A war in the Gulf would destroy his Vision 2030 plans. It would halt global commerce. So he has every reason to use his new leverage with Washington to try and mediate a renewal of a nuclear deal with Iran.
What would that look like?
He could go to the administration and argue for resuming negotiations. Maybe even offering a Gulf state as a neutral location for talks. Or he could float the idea of a regional nuclear consortium.
A consortium?
Yeah, where regional powers, including Saudi Arabia and the UAE, all invest in and participate in a single internationally monitored enrichment facility. It's a potential off-ramp that would satisfy the Saudi desire for nuclear tech, but in a controlled, non-threatening way.
It sounds like Saudi Arabia is using its economic power to push for regional stability, because that's what its own future depends on.
That's the dynamic. The U.S. is focused on what it can get. Investment, burden sharing. MBS is leveraging those needs to get what he needs. Military tech, nuclear security, and above all, stability with Iran.
Okay, we can't finish this without talking about the ethical and political shadow that was hanging over this entire visit.
The elephant in the room.
This was MBS's first time at the White House since the 2018 murder of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, an operation that U.S. intelligence concluded MBS himself likely ordered.
And the reception he got, the military honors, the celebrity dinner, was described by human rights advocates as an extraordinary political feat for the Crown Prince. It was his successful return from being an international pariah.
And when reporters asked about it in the Oval Office, President Trump publicly dismissed the whole controversy.
He was incredibly protective of MBS. He stood right next to him and called Khashoggi extremely controversial. He said, a lot of people didn't like that gentleman, and then added, things happen.
And then he told the reporter not to embarrass our guest. He shut it down completely.
He did. It sent a very potent message that the topic was off limits.
How did MBS respond when he got a chance to address it?
He gave a very carefully worded response. He called the murder painful and a huge mistake, but insisted that the Saudi government did all the right steps to investigate and punish those responsible. He completely insulated himself from any direct involvement.
The reaction from critics was pretty fierce.
It was severe. Journalism Watchdog said Trump's actions sent this worrying global message that autocratic rulers can, quote, literally get away with murder if they're a powerful enough partner. Khashoggi's widow said she was deeply disappointed.
It really highlights that core dilemma in U.S. foreign policy, the constant conflict between American values and American interests.
That's the inescapable tension. Former security officials will tell you that, yes, human rights are often raised privately in these meetings at a lower level. But the public face, the main diplomatic focus, is always on national security. Iran, oil prices, military cooperation, and in this case, that nearly $1 trillion investment.
So for MBS, this visit was the ultimate confirmation.
It was confirmation that wealth and strategic positioning are the ultimate levers of power. The transactional deals clearly superseded any domestic concerns about human rights.
The cost of the partnership for the U.S. was a public willingness to look past those abuses in exchange for security and economic alignment.
Exactly. And it shows how focused the Saudis are on pure real politic. They know they need U.S. technology and security to achieve Vision 2030, and they were willing to commit unprecedented funds to lock in that partnership, overriding any moral reservations Washington previously had.
So let's just recap the staggering scale of what was agreed to here. Saudi Arabia has cemented its military future. They got the major non-NATO ally designation, giving them streamlined access to U.S. tech.
They formalized the deal for the F-35s, advanced drones, hundreds of tanks. It positions them as a major global defense player.
And then there's the money. MBS nearly doubled his investment pledge to almost $1 trillion into the U.S. economy.
With a sharp focus on the future AI, advanced chips using their cheap energy to power a new digital economy. At the end of the day, Saudi Arabia got almost its entire strategic wish list. It's a new transactional relationship where their domestic controversies are just explicitly put to the side.
So what does this all mean for you? Well, this partnership isn't some abstract thing. It has a real impact on global oil prices, on who controls the future of AI, and on that very delicate security balance in the Middle East. We are watching economic power directly purchase military and strategic guarantees.
And that brings us back to that one final constraint, that one thing that still stands in the way. MBS stated clearly that he needs a guaranteed path to a Palestinian state before he'll normalize with Israel.
And we just established that the U.S. offered him almost everything else, MNNA status, F-35s, a potential nuclear umbrella, $1 trillion in investment, the entire wish list short of a defense treaty.
And it still wasn't enough for him to drop that one condition.
So given the scale of everything MBS just got and the fact that it wasn't enough to get him to normalize, it forces a really critical question. If MNNA status, the F-35, and $1 trillion weren't enough leverage to get that final political prize, what on earth could possibly change the status quo in the immediate future? And that's a question we'll leave you with.